There was also some request that maybe we should have more. We hardly ever have it, but occasionally it's happened. Open evening, where I don't come with a talk, but just come. I just show up. and then just see what develops if we just have an open floor and have a discussion, or I take questions, or we have a discussion, you know, talk among ourselves or something. And I think that would be nice, actually. We've done it very occasionally, but to do it occasionally, see, to give an opportunity for something new to happen and arise. The unknown, you know, make space for the unknown, is always good. So, unless there's an overwhelming desire for tonight, I thought I'd give my talk. Otherwise, the talk will be lost. It's very hard to give a talk, you know. I look at my notes next week and say, how could I have thought of saying that? So is that okay? So what I thought of, what I would like to talk about this evening is kind of two topics, and that is the topic of perspective and the topic of concentration, and to tie these together. And insight meditation is a fairly good, insight is a fairly good translation. It's approximate, but pretty good translation of the word vipassana. And vipassana, the V of vipassana is more like, means clear or special, or it's kind of like an emphasizer. And passana means to see, to look or to see. So clear seeing or special kind of seeing is vipassana, which insight kind of works as a nice translation of it. And part of what insight involves as the practice matures and deepens, it involves a shift or a change of perspectives, which is also a nice word because it has the word, you know, spectator or whatever, spectacle in it, to see. But a change of perspective, and it's been said by someone, I don't know who, that mindfulness practice is not about changing what we look at. You know, look at something different, for example, but rather it's changing how we look at things. So it's not seeing something different, but seeing differently. And that's another way of saying that the experience we're having is not so important for the purposes of mindfulness or freedom, but rather it's how we relate to it, how we, our perspective of it, which is important. And perhaps a change of perspective is more important than a change of understanding. Because many people are trying to understand the truth or understand something about Buddhism or themselves as if it's some kind of cognitive idea that they can now have this idea and that's it. But when you say it's a change of perspective, it lends itself to a kind of different emphasis, perhaps. It's not necessarily an idea you're going to get, but rather a kind of a way of seeing, a certain kind of openness or to the world around us. And one of the great helps to changing or shifting our perspective, to seeing differently, is the ability to some degree or other get concentrated. A concentrated mind is a mind which is somewhat quiet, somewhat still, and through that stillness and the quiet, then can see in fresh ways, see in new ways. And the seeing freshly then is maybe part of this change of perspective. And the what's become now almost the immortal words of or phrase of Suzuki Roshi, the idea of a beginner's mind, that what's important is a beginner's mind, not the mind of an expert. The idea being that an expert sees only the few appropriate responses, whereas the beginner's mind might see lots of infinite possibilities and sees things freshly. Someone, now I forget who it was. Yesterday. There was someone who told me that when he was young, he started studying books in Buddhism when he was like 15. And when he was, and he'd read, you know, a fair number of books on Buddhism and Zen and different things for a couple of years. And then when he was 17, his father gave him Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind to read. And he didn't want to read it because he thought it was a beginner's book on Zen. And he'd already read a couple of books on Zen. He wasn't a beginner anymore. So, and then many years later, someone explained to him that the beginner's mind was not just being a beginner, exactly. But a concentrated mind is one that allows for a shift of perspective, allows for us to see freshly, perhaps. And it's really remarkable to me how often our understanding of events is one of perhaps many perspectives that can be had of an event. And we don't often remember that, so we often think that my particular understanding is the right one, the one we get attached to or fixated on or the one we act on. And often there's many different perspectives that are more or less valid because we take a tremendous amount of primary information and the mind processes it in various ways to come up with some kind of interpretation of the event, some kind of opinion or judgment or whatever. And we don't often see how much judgment, interpretation, history and conditioning goes into our understanding of a particular event, our perspective. And part of the value of a quiet and calm mind is a mind which doesn't come with so much conditioning that then becomes a filter for seeing the situation. But simply, what happens to our understanding of an event when we simply remember that there may be many other perspectives besides mine that are operating here? And then maybe we have kind of, we hold our perspective a little bit looser. It might be that our perspective is a fine one, but if you realize it's one of many, what happens to you? What happens to you in that situation? Perhaps we're more willing to listen to the other people to find out what their perspective is, to get a better idea. So a different change of perspective. One of my first insights into this was when I was a college student at UC Davis in the wintertime. And they had this, tule fog in the Central Valley. And in the wintertime, it was really cold. It would be really low-lying fog in this cold winter. And I would ride my bicycle to school every day, early in the morning. And I didn't have gloves, so it was bitingly cold, this fog going against my hands. And I used to go to school tighten up, and my hands were just really sharply cold. And I was really miserable and full of self-pity and poor me and how many more blocks do I have to do to get to school and it happened day after day. I'd be kind of miserable and upset. And then one day, I was biking to school and feeling all this, intense, sharp cold in my hands. And it was really intense because I get to class and I couldn't really hold a pencil for a while because I'm kind of numb out from the cold. So you can see it was cold. But one day I was riding to school, and I recognized that the sensations I had of cold in my hand were exactly the same sensations I used to have when I was skiing. And I was really ecstatic. I was really high, it was great. And suddenly I began wondering, what was really going on here? And what was I interpreting? What was I adding to the situation that helped make me miserable when I was riding my bike? And what was I adding to the situation that was making me ecstatic when I was up in the ski slopes? It was exactly the same sensations in my hands. So that kind of woke me up a little bit and said, wait a minute, what's going on here in life? What's the role of interpretation and ideas to our primary experience? There's an example also given, which maybe is a disgusting example. The word disgusting really means can't be tasted in Latin. So that's how it's disgusting. But it's given sometimes, so there's precedent saying this example. And that is, if you take your saliva and you kind of wish it around your mouth and in through your teeth and rub your tongue against it, it can kind of feel nice sometimes, a little bit. It's kind of smooth and, flowing and watery, whatever. And many of us have this experience, it's okay to have our saliva in our mouth. But then if you spit it out into a plate, and then you take and then you take and lick it up and put it back in your mouth, nothing's really changed. It's exactly the same saliva. But now suddenly kind of this gag reflex comes into play and it's really disgusting, Oh my God. Now what's really changing? Is it just, how much of this is a perspective thing And how much of it has to do with really the nature of the saliva, which is this, you know, the poor saliva hasn't changed at all. It's rather innocent. That's why it's okay. So I don't know what you think of that example, but
is that like handed down, or did you think of it yourself?
Did you hear what Bonnie said? You heard, huh? What Bonnie said. Was that example handed down, or do you think of it yourself? Well, in answer, I'll tell you, I read once that all wisdom is plagiarism. Only foolishness is original. So, we'll see. Well, I had a series of examples. I don't know if I dare or not. There's a book called, I think it's called something like, it's called Mindfulness. It's by Susan Lang, I think, is that her name? She wrote this beautiful book on mindfulness. Susan Langer. And and she's a psychologist, a researcher, who's studying, who claims she has no contact or no real involvement with Eastern religion, Buddhism, and mindfulness, and just taken the idea of mindfulness as it appears kind of in the Western context, and studied it, its role in daily life and its role in people's lives, and has published a wonderful little book on it. And she talks about how people can be mindless also, the mechanisms of mindlessness. And she talks about premature cognitive commitments as a source of mindlessness. And this is where we commit ourselves cognitively to some idea prematurely, before we really understand it. And this is, you know, for, you know, riding my bicycle, I've committed myself to the, you know, to the cognitive idea that this is really terrible and awful and I can't stand it and poor me and why am I riding a bicycle and why couldn't I have, you know, a car and the heater and, you know. And this whole world gets created, right, because I've committed myself to this perspective. And it's just a perspective. And so how many times do we do this, kind of premature cognitive commitment? It's a great expression, huh? Well, you can use it a lot and call it PCC. And she gives the example in her book of the story of the ugly duckling as someone who takes on a premature cognitive commitment. And the ugly duckling is born, and the first thing he sees is this big duck, and he makes this false premature cognitive commitment that the first thing he sees, the first big animal he sees, is his mother. And it's a duck. He's not a duck, right? But it's a duck. So he makes a commitment, oh, this must be my mother. That's the first mistake. And the second premature cognitive commitment is that since I'm a duck, and since I look so different from my brothers and sisters, something's wrong with me, and I'm ugly. And because I'm an ugly duck, because I'm a duck, right? And that's also called, you know, she calls that a premature cognitive commitment. Because he's not a duck, he just has this perspective. And from this comes this, you know, shame and feeling of being alone and all that. And lo and behold, he turns out to be not a duck at all, but turns out to be a wonderful, beautiful swan. And I think that's a very good a fairy tale for all of us. Because probably most of us make premature cognitive commitments about who we think we are long before we have a chance to blossom into our swanhood. Or maybe, you know, it covers up our swanhood. She also gives the example in her book of, she uses the example of a woman walking down the road, and is attacked by a swarm of bees. And at least Susan Langer kind of imagines this woman then would respond perhaps with kind of frantic fear, lots of fear. In some way respond out of the fear to all these swarm of bees attacking her. And then she says, then if you imagine, if a woman was walking down the street with a small child and they are both attacked by a swarm of bees, her response would be very different, she claims. And rather than being afraid, she might be very aggressive or get angry or get defensive, but she wouldn't exactly get afraid because there's this young child to protect, and the child is more important than herself. And so still, she's being attacked by the same bunch of bees. But there's a huge difference in the emotional response depending on the context and how things change. And she gives an example again of how context and how perspective of a situation can affect so much of how we interpret a situation and how much how we respond to it. People who meditate a lot will often recognize the degree in which premature cognitive commitments come into play around pain. We decide that, oh, this pain, you know, oh my God, my knee, and it must mean that, well, it probably needs to be amputated, you know, or if it any more now, and or you know, it hurts a little bit, you know, on your back, and oh my God, you know, it must be a tumor, and we make all these decisions and ideas, you know, off we go. We spend the next 45 minutes in the sitting, kind of thinking about doctors and doctor bills, because we have a certain perspective of what it means. But one place you see it in sitting is a lot of people have this experience, maybe many of you, especially if you go on retreat and you're sitting for a long time, and you have a certain amount of pain, and you can't stand it, and you think you can't manage another minute. And then after a while, you know, you don't think, this is impossible, I'm going to burst, I can't take it, not even another second can I take it. And you're really gritting your teeth and really kind of, and then they ring the bell. And maybe the teacher says something or something, rings a bell. And after a while, you notice a minute later, you're still sitting there. You haven't moved and changed. And what happened to the pain? You thought you couldn't manage another second. And as soon as they ring the bell, somehow there's this relaxation and release, but you haven't changed your posture. And our relationship, our perspective, our ideas about what pain is often what builds up this intense internal turmoil. That has nothing has lot, very little to do with the primary experience of pain, but has a lot to do with the perspective we have on it. And I know that one of the things that can come through meditation practice is having a different perspective to discomfort of all sorts, where it's more okay to experience discomfort because we become less and less conditioned to interpret it or to see it through old perspectives and conditioning, that this is bad or wrong or whatever. Just leave it be as it is. So we add all this meaning to what pain means, and where sometimes meaning is not really the issue. It's just painful. Susan Langer gives the example of fasting. She did all these fascinating experiments, mindfulness experiments, and I guess one of them was they had people fast, and some of the people they had fast for their own personal reasons. They wanted to fast because it was good for their health or whatever. And then other group of people, they had them fast, but they just gave them $25 to fast. Or they told them they were part of a scientific experiment or something. And the people who were fasting for their own reasons, the people who were fasting because they were being paid $25, got hungry a lot earlier. And again, the tremendous effect on interpretation of context, of perspective in a situation, influences so much of how we relate to a situation. And then another example of maybe premature cognitive, the advertisement uses premature cognitive commitments a lot to get us hooked in. And one of the places maybe you see it is in futon stores and Persian carpet stores, where they seem to always have a sale. They're always going out of business. And I begin maybe to suspect that, you know, maybe they're not. I've seen the same sign for 20 years, going out of business. But what they're trying to do is to try to get you to kind of have this premature cognitive commitment that, oh, I'm going to get a really good deal here. And so you go in and you're more likely to buy at these exorbitant prices. Calvin and Hobbes, they're sitting out there in the woods, and Calvin says, "The problem with people is they don't look at the big picture. Eventually, we're each going to die. Our species will go extinct, the sun will explode, the universe will collapse. Existence is not only temporary, it's pointless. we're all doomed, and worse, nothing matters. And Hobbes looks somewhat kind of amazed, and he says, I see why people don't like to look at the big picture. Well, it puts a bad day in perspective. Well, you know, there's many ways of changing your perspective. There are two perspectives that that insight practice works a lot with. One has to do with shifting from perhaps a premature cognitive commitment to permanence, to impermanence, from a notion of a fixed idea of self to a more fluid idea of self. And the first one is we start seeing that all things pass. And the seeing that all things pass is actually a very powerful insight. And to see it in very minute ways is even more powerful. And it shifts, I believe, our relationship to life a lot when we start appreciating that all things will pass. All our relationships that we have will pass. Everybody we know is going to die sooner or later. Some things change quicker than others. Some things are completely a surprise out of the blue, and from one day to the next, the person's life is turned upside down. One friend of mine, perhaps as many people, was very moved by all the famous deaths we've had in recent weeks, with Princess Diana and Mother Teresa, and there was an Indian guru that a lot of people were connected to that died recently. And he was very moved by this and felt, you know, the preciousness of life and how short, how temporary and permanent all our lives are, and we don't never know when we're going to go. And as a result of this, he started calling his various friends to express his appreciation of them and his love of them, because he didn't know, you know, you never know when you'll get the chance again, and he didn't want to miss the opportunity. And just to kind of connect to him, it kind of changed his values a little bit. And the shift of perspective to seeing things as being permanent, this is the way it's going to be forever, to seeing things, oh, this is going to last for a while, but all things pass, is one that at least, I think, tends to give us a perspective that things are more precious, maybe more valuable, more to be cared for and loved, and allowed to pass when they go away, not to hold on to them. To fixate on this is the way things have to be forever is a real recipe for suffering. And one of the things we hold on as being permanent is some fixed idea of who we are, some notion that this is who I am, and which is also a recipe for suffering. Because if nothing else, as soon as we say, this is who I am, we've limited ourselves to some kind of idea. And we're always going to be more than any idea we can have of ourselves. So there's kind of a shift when we start seeing, shifting our perspective from permanence to impermanence, from self to non-self. There's a shift also from the idea of this is who I am this fixed way, I am unworthy, I'm wonderful, I'm, you know, whatever your favorite expression is. Shift from that to maybe you don't know who you are. And this I don't know who I am is considered in Buddhism a kind of wisdom. It can be done, of course, out of total confusion. But it can also be done out of wisdom, because we don't really know who we are. And we don't really discover who we are until we've acted in a particular situation. And then we know ourselves in that situation. And then that becomes history. And then we don't know ourselves again until the next situation when we act. And so we're always finding ourselves and discovering ourselves in whatever we're doing in the moment, not in our memories, or this is who I was yesterday, therefore this is the way I am today. And a lot of, just the last thing about this, is a lot of our ideas about who we are, fixed ideas, arises out of comparative thinking, because we compare ourselves against others. And so we have then, because of that, we often suffer. I gave the example of this a few weeks ago. I'll do it again. When I was maybe 14 or so and living in Italy, I think it was 1968, I thought I was really cool, because compared to the other Italian kids, I had the longest hair and the most washed out blue jeans with patches and whatever. But when I came back to America after that stay in Italy, I was no longer the coolest kid in the block, because now my hair was relatively short compared to how everybody had changed in the time I was gone. And my blue jeans weren't as faded as everyone else's. And now I was not so happy about myself. I'd gone from being proud about myself to being somewhat feeling embarrassed or not good about myself. And the only thing that changed was this context of the situation, the perspective changed. And the sense of who I was born in comparison to the people around me. And that's a very fragile way to think of who you are. So concentration is as a way of learning to shift our perspective, to see afresh, to see in new ways. If nothing else, a concentrated mind is one that's not preoccupied with our conditioning. The conditioning operates less strongly. The mind, all those conditioning voices that help kind of interpret the situation are somewhat stilled and quiet. And just doing that is enough to give us kind of a fresh view of what's going on. And sometimes people have the experience of sitting in meditation or sitting on retreat. At the end of the sitting, at the end of the retreat, they go out into the streets or back into society. And it's just things seem to sparkle in a new way, because we don't take them kind of through the old eyes, the old expectations. So just simply getting quiet and concentrated can give us a new, fresh look. But maybe that's enough to say about that, is that it's very, very useful to have this tool of concentration, to be able to drop below our normal conditioning that filters how we see. And then to come out of that, as we come out of that state of concentration, to start looking with a fresh perspective. And what that means is that what happens to you as you leave your meditation session is as important as what happens to you in your meditation. Whatever happens in your meditation is fine. If you get a little bit quieter, a little bit calmer, whatever, even just a little bit. But then if you use that calm, then to look around and notice what happens to you as you leave the sitting, the meditation. To look at the world around you, to look at your friends, your family, to look at yourself, and what gets reborn in your conditioning, your ideas and interpretations, as you leave that calm state is a very, very important place for mindfulness students to study, to pay attention to. And you can see how the conditioning gets reborn. And if you can see how it gets reborn, how it comes back into play, there's more possibility of seeing, oh, this is optional. But if you don't study the change of how this gets kind of comes back, creeps back in, and suddenly we're lost in all our past conditioning again, then it's very hard to see it when you're in the middle of the forest. But if you leave the forest for a little bit, you can see the trees as you go back in. It's the basic idea. So concentration. So how do we get concentrated? How do we develop a calmer or stiller mind? The usual way, the simplest description of the practice of concentration is to settle the mind on a relatively simple object, relatively simple, unitary one thing, and just let the mind rest there and be there, and so the mind doesn't get pulled away into distraction and other activities. But that kind of description often lends itself to a kind of willful way of being concentrated, a forced way. And people hear, oh, I should get concentrated, and suddenly their mind becomes this kind of paranoid, you know, laser that's going to, you know, hook on and freeze on and you know, grab onto something and strain and huff and puff. And all you get is a headache instead of being concentrated. Or it becomes very mechanical, the attempt to be present. It works a lot better to develop concentration if there's a kind of sense of ease and maybe even casualness to it. And it's not so much about forcing oneself as it is to finding some object, something you pay attention to, that's maybe somewhat a little bit pleasant, something enjoyable to be with. And for some people it can be the breath or some parts of the breath. Some people it can be just listening to sounds or other sensations in the body. Or something about the breath which is enjoyable. Or simply a way of being with the breath, kind of settling and relaxing into the breath, relaxing into some sensation in the body. And then from that relaxed kind of place, restful place, kind of resting with it, settling into it, from that place of being settled and rested, being very vigilant that your mind doesn't wander away. which it will try to do. It'll go off into all kinds of thoughts and ideas, or into other things pulling its attention. But being very vigilant, so your mind doesn't leave that place of settled ease with that situation. Now, settled ease is a relative thing. It just can be just a itsy bitsy bit. So that to ensure that you don't do mechanical or force when you try to be concentrated on something. So you have a little bit of, ease or enjoyment or something in the experience. So we sit here and we're going to follow our breath. Instead of, with our forehead or our eyes kind of fixing on the breath, now I'm going to follow it. You sit here and you take a deep breath and you kind of relax and let go and you settle into the breath and you're kind of a settling of the body. And then you kind of be with the breath a little bit and see, as I breathe out, as I breathe in and out, can I be a little bit more in the inside of the breath, in the inside of the body as I breathe? And can I kind of settle into it? Can I relax it? Can I be kind of a little bit, find some ease in it? And then you find a little, even just a hint of it, to use that as a guide, as a clue, to kind of help you stay there a little bit, and how to be with it so you don't start straining and making it mechanical. And then part of getting concentrated then is really learning to let go of distractions and being interested and willing to let go of distractions. Because many of us, for whatever unusual strange reasons or good reasons, will often are much more interested in our distractions than we are in our breath. And it can be the most silly distractions, it's amazing, what the mind will get involved in as you sit. And there's a kind of interest that happens there. And if the interest is greater on the breathing, or if the interest is greater, and let's see what it's like not to get caught up in those thoughts. If you're really interested, what is it like if I don't take that, that detour into thinking about, my work tomorrow? What if I don't do that? What if I don't plan tomorrow? What if I just stay there with this thing I decided to stay with the breath? What happens if I do that? And what will happen is if you really do it carefully and with a sense of ease and without any judgment and without any expectation, without any idea that anything's supposed to happen, you can just stay with it in a very, very simple way and trust that being very, very simple and mundane even with the breath, and breath is nothing special to it, just stay with it and stay with it. Don't kind of allow your mind to wander off, or if it wanders off, come right back. That can slowly, slowly develop strength of concentration. It might take weeks or months or years, but it slowly it'll come to all of us. And as that happens, we develop a shift of perspective. And the shift of perspective can happen in many ways. We can see the world differently, but also we see ourselves differently. And one of the ways we see ourselves differently is that as we get more concentrated, the normal judgments and conditioned ways of thinking that we have about ourselves are put at rest. Because if you're concentrated, you can't really think so well about these other things, ideas you have of yourself. And if the conditioned ways we think about ourselves are put to rest, most of which are often rather unsavory, then a different sense, different experience of who we are has a chance to kind of reveal itself. And what will often reveal itself when our surface conditioning is no longer operating, there's a little bit better, more sense of well-being, or more sense that we're okay, or we're fine the way we are, because that's actually the case. And so to have a chance to get concentrated and rest for a while, in this, even it's a little bit more sense of okayness than you usually have, begins to recondition the mind, that maybe our original perspective of ourselves maybe isn't the only perspective to have of ourselves. Maybe we can have other perspectives of ourselves than the idea that I'm unworthy or I'm bad or I'm guilty or I'm shameful or, that we have. And so we can then learn to rest and trust a little bit, perhaps, this non-conditioned way of being with ourselves. And the non-conditioned way of being with ourselves is a place where a lot of well-being and trust can develop. So learning to leave ourselves alone in peace. So I'd say a little bit, some trepidation to talk about, to encourage you to develop more concentration. because many people will try and feel frustrated and feel like they're doing it wrong then, and they can't do it and get very frustrated. And that's not the spirit of the practice. The spirit of the practice is just really to accept us as we are, unconcentrated or not. But I think it's useful to kind of nudge you in the direction of developing more concentration occasionally. So I would encourage some of you maybe to experiment and see if when you sit, you can sit with greater interest to get a little bit more settled in a more one-pointed way. This, I'm just going to stay with the breathing. And this is really what I'm going to do for a while. Maybe you try this maybe for a few weeks or a few months. I'm going to do the kind of, you know, the just really simple practice and not do all the mindfulness that, you know, I know the full instructions for mindfulness practice. I know how to be open to everything. But I'm going to actually not do that for a few weeks. What I'm going to do is really try to develop concentration and kind of a stillness or a settledness of mind. And if it doesn't seem to interest you or it's not a nice thing to do, you don't have to do it. There's absolutely no requirement in this universe for any of us ever to get concentrated. And we're not any worse for it. But if you get really concentrated, then you can understand why that's the case. So what are your thoughts tonight? Yes.
I want to know why you didn't put gloves on your hands.
Maybe I was dumb. Maybe I thought I was uncool. I don't remember. I didn't have much money, so maybe I couldn't afford it.
Do you think there's a physiological basis to concentration?
Yes. Now, what do you mean by that?
Someone who's restless might have a physiological basis.
Yes. Oh, in that sense. Yes, so there are physiological basis for some people to be more or less concentrated. Some people are more, more scattered in their minds. Some people are less. There's a lot of discussion about that in the last 10 years in the medical field, attention deficit people and things like that. For some people, it's been very useful to have a kind of diagnosis of their situation. And the downside of it is that people jump on the bandwagon too early, too quickly. So, oh, I must be one of these people who has attention deficit disorder, and you know, it's hopeless, and you know, it becomes a perspective. It's not necessarily so. So it has its benefits and its disadvantages. This kind of idea. So we have to be careful. But yeah, there can be, and that's why I think mindfulness practice, which is not concentration practice, is a very beautiful practice because it's an acceptance practice. And what we're learning to do is to accept ourselves as we are. And it's possible to accept ourselves for having an unconcentrated mind and be at ease with that somehow. And I think that's very valuable. And that's really the basis of mindfulness practice, is acceptance of who we are and accept ourselves in all the different ways. So please, if you feel that either your ability to get concentrated or not concentrated has a physiological basis, remember that concentration is just one of many tools that can help us to be more accepting and more loving. That's all it is. You're not more spiritual because you get concentrated. You can actually get less spiritual. Getting concentrated can be a way of numbing out. Concentration tends to be overvalued in spiritual and meditation circles. But it's a tool, and as all tools, it can be misused. Yeah?
Since we like to look at the origins of words or the meanings of words, one of the meanings of concentration I was thinking earlier is to thicken. When you boil something down, you concentrate it and it becomes thicker. And one of the nice things about a thick substance is that it's hard to divert. It really does stay in the stream, but it's a good laugh to think of getting thick.
Oh, I think it's nice. I think it's very nice. When we get concentrated, actually we're thickening inside. You know, harder to remove. Well, certainly more centered and more stable, but in a different way than kind of rigid and hard. There's a kind of feeling of filling out that happens with being concentrated. So rather than me kind of more and more kind of tight and high-strung in the mind, which some people end up when they're concentrated. It's more of a sense of, in the one-pointedness, in the concentration, there's kind of a filling out of a sense of wholeness or unity or pressure or whatever, a kind of thickening of our aura, or, you know, who knows what it is, but it feels like it goes beyond us.
It wouldn't splash and shatter.
Yeah, the thickening.
So
everyone, please get thicker. Thicken up. Yes?
I have a good friend that I initially couldn't stand because she's so nice and kind of Pollyannish, and we went camping together and stopped at this beach to go running, and I took off first, and there was a dead seal on the beach with a vulture on it, and the sand was really steep, and I came back and I thought, oh, I just won't say anything to her. And she took off and forgot about it. And then that night we were driving and talking a lot about how did we ever become friends, because we're so different, and really puzzling over our different perspectives. And I said, well, in some ways it's just like that dead seal on the beach, you know, because I got really hung up on it. And you know what she said? What seal? So sometimes I have this suspicion about people that are too nice. Or
they're not paying attention?
Yeah, I don't know.
They don't realize how horrible everything is and how...
They're wrong.
Well, if you're going to shift your perspective, you have to at least begin seeing. Energy or effort. Okay, so thank you all for tonight, and I wish you well.